Hi, everybody. We have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltinonmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltinonmovies. Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies, and today we're going to discuss a career that is more television-oriented than movie-oriented. But I have to tell you, our guests have just created a show that is out of this world. And Jesse, why don't you do the honors?
Well, no, it's... So first of all, we're Jews, obviously. So the show A Small Light is so important to us. But you've also done a whole bunch of other stuff that's pretty great. And it's been so long since I've been in the same room as Jeffrey where I can actually say that, because normally I'm always talking about him, but whenever he calls me and he tells me he has guests, I say yes. I think I've said yes every single time you ever asked me, because he only works with fascinating people, and that's what you guys are.
And the names are?
He wants to get it right.
Tony Phelan and Joan Rader.
That's right. You got it right.
You got it right.
Phelan.
That's right.
Phelan and Rader. Pray.
And you've created this incredible 8-episode evocation of the life of Miep Gies.
Am I getting that's right?
That's right.
Yeah. All about pronunciations today.
Yeah.
a woman who was deeply involved in the story of Anne Frank and her family.
That's right.
Otto Frank, played beautifully by Liev Schreiber. And I can only encourage you to watch it, folks.
Yeah.
It's not like taking medicine. It's not like it's good for you. You should watch this for that reason.
Though it is that.
Though it is
also that.
But it is just so gripping and so authentic. It takes you there. You are in a different time and place, and you're on this journey, this life journey with the Frank family and with the woman who became, the young woman who became their connection to the outside world, their enabler. I don't mean that in any negative sense.
You brought them a lot of drugs, which I think we would all need if we were stuck in an attic for that long.
And it is absolutely compelling viewing.
And Belle Powley's fantastic. And we want to get into that show.
Yep.
But once we do, we're not going to get back out again. So I want to start with everything else.
Yay.
Okay.
Because this is not your first rodeo by a long shot. And I do, I love Fire Country. I think it's
so
much
great.
Fun.
Yay.
Well, I've watched Max Thério since he was a child.
I know.
I think he and I are about the same age. And
we tried so hard not to make Fire Country. We got a call.
Because our career has primarily been in network television.
Sure. And we wanted to make A Small Light. We were making A Small Light, damn it. And Christy Ann Reed called us from Bruckheimer TV and said, this guy Max, he's from this fire town. He has this show. It's a fire show. It's really cool. CBS wants it. And I said, We're not your people. Thank you. Thank you so much. We're doing this thing called A Small Light, but thank you. We're not going to do it. And she said, no, you are. You're going to take the meeting. And when somebody,
who are you to say
I
no?
said, okay, I'll take the meeting, but we're not going to do it. And then we took the meeting and Max started talking about, first of all, Fire Country is interesting to us because it's a show. It's real. Cal Fire, the wildland firefighters in California, use inmate firefighters. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
How did I not know that? And their stories of redemption and second chances and the whole thing was really interesting. So when Max started talking about it, I was like, oh,
damn it.
We're doing a fire show.
Yeah, we're doing a fire show in between the Holocaust show and the fire show.
But it allowed us to do something that to talk about social justice, to talk about the criminal justice system, mm-hmm. to talk about and as John said, to talk about things like redemption and mm-hmm. is rehabilitation actually possible?
Yeah.
And so to make that about a family in this small town was just really compelling to us.
You've got a great cast of people, yeah. too.
Wait, yeah. P.S., I'll tell a story that tells you everything you need to know about me. We've done a bunch of shows, Tony and I, for CBS, and they're always canceled. So...
We can get them on the air, but they get canceled.
I get it.
The ratings.
My wife was a big, big...
Madam Secretary.
Supporter of Madam Secretary.
Well, that one I didn't create, so of course it did very well. We created a show called Doubt, and we created a show called Council of Dads. That was for NBC. But when Fire Country came around, all I know is the network wants these ratings, and you never get them, and then you get canceled. That's my life.
Right.
So we were in Prague shooting A Small Light, and Fire Country was premiering, and I gathered the writers on the Zoom, and I said, okay, you guys, I want you tonight to just feel really proud of yourselves and take it in, because tomorrow is going to be hard, because the ratings are going to be bad. But it doesn't mean you didn't do a good job.
Right, yeah.
Okay? And so they were all like, okay, Joan.
Thanks,
so
Mom.
The next day, the ratings were better than expected. So what did I do? The next week, I get them on the Zoom. Those ratings were great. Yes. It was a fluke. This week, they'll be
terrible.
The numbers
will go down.
Yeah.
And they just kept going up.
Are you Jewish? Because this is very, much our people.
Yeah. It's we come from television trauma. So. Yeah.
No, it is true, but this is a thing that comes up a lot. You speak to different actors, and you can look through and see the 87 shows they were on that had an episode or some episodes, a couple of episodes. And it's like, you know, that's why when you speak to a lot of people, they're not bold in going, oh, yeah, this was a success and that was a success.
Right.
Because in their minds, they're going, yeah, that one was.
Yeah.
Right.
But those 40 others.
I got to tell you, as a creator, seeing, you know, my heroes with their one-shot wonders, seeing, going, oh, my God, he did
Absolutely.
That, and that was canceled, is so helpful.
Of course.
I always tell young writers, we didn't make a dime as writers till I was 37 or 38. Mm. I mean, I know my way around a waitressing job, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. Who did you just have at class? This was their first... screenplay that was actually made.
Yeah, yeah. I had several. I had two.
Teaches at USC now for 25 years.
Where they've made a living.
Right.
They've made a good living as screenwriters, though nothing of theirs has been produced.
Right.
Nothing.
Right.
And this was the first time in like 20 years. One of them, it was something like 20 years. And the other one, it was slightly shorter. But it's just, I don't think people understand.
Yeah.
And that's also why when something is a success,
people are thrilled. So many disparate elements need to come together in just the right cocktail to make it happen. Yep. And those are rare.
When we were on Grey's Anatomy, I remember it was...
Was that a hit?
Have you heard of it?
Did that go well for you?
Let me tell you this. Okay. We got offered three jobs that season.
Of course you did.
Grey's Anatomy, this medical show. A new Law and Order called Law and Order Trial by Jury and Medium with Glenn Caron.
Mm-hmm.
And so we said, obviously, we're going to do this new Law and Order. It's going to run forever.
Mm-hmm.
We took that job. And then it wasn't going to run forever. It became pretty clear. And I was in a Starbucks and I overheard these people in front of me saying, did you watch that new medical show last night? And I was like, Damn it, what happened? So I called the people. I called my agent. Do they need people? Can we get back on there? And it turns out they did. And he said, okay, but you got to decide if you're going to jump ship tonight. I'm not sure if you should. You got to. So I called my mother in the Midwest, who's a nurse, and my dad's a doctor. And I said, Mom, you got to watch this new medical show, Grey's Anatomy, tonight, and tell me, should we jump off this Law and Order? I don't know. She called me the next day, and she said, Joan, I have been a nurse in this hospital for 25 years, and I have never had sex in a supply closet. I think you stay on the Law and Order. And I was like, check, we're going on Grey's Anatomy.
And you've never spoken to your mother ever again. You said, Mom, you ruined my life, and now it's all over.
And you had a killer cast on that Law and Order.
We had a killer cast on that Law & Order. We had B.B. Newworth, and it was Jerry Orbach's last show, and it was great. It was just, it was a case of changing the formula a little bit and not having the police on it and just having the lawyers, and it didn't come together.
Yeah.
You know?
If it was a formula.
Yeah.
Then everybody would be following the same formula, you know, drinking the same Kool-Aid.
That's right.
And being 100% successful
all the time. Yeah,
we talked about so much the chess show.
Oh, the Queen's Gambit.
Thank you.
Yeah.
If that hadn't happened during a pandemic, now I think it's a fantastic show. I really enjoyed it. But would you ever imagine that to be number one?
Right.
No.
Because most people would go, "It's about chess," and run the other direction.
Right.
What happened was we were all trapped. And people went, new content.
Right.
We also really hate the word content.
Yes.
But it's like, new content. And everybody watched it.
Yeah.
And that's wonderful because something that otherwise I don't think would have gotten that kind of attention got that kind of attention.
Yeah.
But it's also like, oh, they must have planned. They must have said, let's set the world on fire and see what happens. Because it's just nuts.
Yeah. And it's another of those things that's just totally out of your control. You can't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As I said, so many elements. Some of them you can have a hand in, and some of them, for example, with A Small Light, Nat Geo, Disney Plus, totally got behind this show and are really putting their shoulder to the wheel to get it out, to get people to see it. And we've never experienced anything like this. We had a series of premieres, first at South by Southwest, then Cannes, then Amsterdam, then London, then New York, than Washington, D.C.
Wow.
We're movie stars. We feel like movie stars. We're movie stars.
Wow.
Yeah.
I called CBS and said, next season on Fire Country, you're going to be flying us around the world, right? And they were like,
you're going to go to lots of different firehouses.
That's right.
And
you're
going to hang out in a bunch of jails. No, it's the kind of thing where you just don't know. And this is true, we know, for film as well. If something suddenly becomes the thing that a studio gets behind, especially during awards season, suddenly an indie director who is usually thrilled to death if craft services has some chips, is being put on a private plane and sent to God knows where doing all this stuff. It's just not, it's wild. So so you grew up in the Midwest. Where did you grow up?
In Milwaukee.
And where did you grow up?
Cleveland.
And where did you meet?
We met in front of La Mama.
In New York.
In New York.
On a snowy Saturday before Thanksgiving, I was waiting to meet my friend who was bringing his friend from acting school, looked down the street and saw this woman with white hair and red gloves walking towards me. And I was like, wow.
That was me.
That was another woman who's not here anymore.
Joan was right behind her.
Joan was friendly with her, though. And it worked out well. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
And how long have you been married?
We've been married
30 years.
Yeah.
And you know, in Hollywood, that's 876.
Oh, I know.
As I say this, my parents just had 48, which is roughly 1,000.
So you were both actors at the time?
No, Joan was an actress and I was a theater director.
Okay.
And so we spent our first 12 years after school in New York in the theater.
Wow.
So, and
Tony was actually successful. He did a lot of musicals for TheaterWorks USA.
Yeah.
That does the family musicals that tour.
Yeah.
And gives a lot of people their
equity card.
Yeah.
And I was mostly depressed and crying at home.
That sounds right.
My depressive crying story, tales of woe, were funny. And so Tony said, you know, even when you're depressed, you're very funny. We should do bits. You should do a one-woman show. And so we started working together like that, just as a way to get me out of the house and to get an acting agent. And we were working at La Mama, and an agent came up to me and said, I'm a literary agent. Your writing is amazing.
Huh.
I want to represent you. And I was like, no, how dare you? I'm an actress. Cut to a year later, I was like, what was her name? Maybe I'll give her a call. So it sort of started just storytelling. I didn't realize it was writing that we were doing together.
Yeah.
And but you were a director, not a writer.
I was a director, not a writer. So I was on kind of a parallel track, and I'd gotten a grant from the Williamstown Theater Festival to go up for a summer, spend the first half of the summer writing an original piece, and then the second half of the summer with a young company doing the piece.
Yeah.
And so gradually we found ourselves doing more writing and doing more original material. And that kind of led to, we did an adaptation of a Jane Smiley novella. Jane Smiley wrote 1,000 Acres. So she writes about Midwest farm communities. And she had this novella called Goodwill that we were both in love with. And we did it off Broadway, and I directed it, and it was pretty successful and came close to being made into a film. And then that kind of fell through. But a friend of mine from Williamstown was out here and said, come here to LA. We'll do a reading of the play and at my theater company, and that you guys can come out and it'll be fun.
We thought, oh my God, we're going to do a reading in LA and all the famous people will be there.
Right, of course.
Well, 7 people were there.
And there were 8 people in the cast.
And but one of the 7 was a woman who was a manager. And so it got us started coming out here and getting an agent and all that stuff. So my advice to any young people are, even if there are 7 people, you know, don't hang your head in shame. Go out there.
Quality over the quantity of it.
That's right.
Exactly.
You never know.
Now, isn't it not strange, not funny? It's something. it says a lot that almost every successful television enterprise comes from people grounded in theater.
Yeah.
Theater is the common bond, the common root, you know.
Well, when you think about it, the as a television writer, your job is to come onto somebody else's show, mimic their voice, and then be able to endlessly rewrite yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And we had all sorts of experience doing that because you take our play Goodwill went through 2 years of development, of constant readings and rewrites and notes and going back and forth to the point where that's just, you're very comfortable doing that.
Yeah. On Grey's Anatomy, the writing staff, save 1 or 2, were actors and actresses.
Yeah.
So there were a lot of getting up and acting out entrances and exits and surgery.
Yeah.
You know, and you're right. It's theater people gone legit.
I think it's also stamina. I mean, that's the other thing is if you are an actor on stage or you're a stagehand or anything with live theater, you have to have that stamina to be able to do it again and again and again. And as an actor, you have to be able to do it again and again and again, knowing that it's a different audience and they deserve everything you've got every single night, sometimes twice.
Yep.
It's exhausting. It is exhausting.
Well, I think it also helps, too, to not be... to be a friend of rejection, to know that is simply part of the job.
And it's not you.
I just saw Michael Keaton say this great thing where he was like, he had a moment as an actor where he was like, oh, my work is not the getting the job. My work is the fact that I get to go into a room and for 10 or 15 minutes, I get to do my thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think as writers, it's kind of the same thing. It's if you love the writing of it, if you love just sitting down, and especially what was new to us as people from the theater was the great community of being in a writer's room and collaboration. It's really exciting and fun, and once you experience it, you don't want to do it any other way.
Yeah, which is one of the reasons that the Writers Guild is on strike right now.
Yeah,
exactly.
One of the root causes of this terrible but necessary impasse.
Companies want to change the way the we make the widgets.
Yeah,
but they don't want to change the way they pay us to make the widgets.
Right.
Yeah.
So
right.
Hilarious that you wouldn't have a show. And you won't have a show unless someone writes the show. But why keep them happy? Oh, wait. You don't have anything if they don't write anything. Not that I'm angry about this. But no, it's a very strange thing to me. This whole conversation is strange because you just go, why are we having this conversation? if they don't write it, you don't have anything.
Yeah,
I don't understand where the disconnect is.
It's interesting because when we started, we moved out to LA in 2000, and when we started, there was still this sense that the studios were family businesses with people who had grown up in the industry or come to it, but understood the business of what we were doing.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And in the past 20 years, those families are gone. It's now huge multinationals where this is another division.
Yeah.
And they want to run this division the way they run every other division. And that's, they're breaking the system in order to save a couple pennies.
Right. And that system includes those collaborative meetings.
Yeah.
You know, in writers' rooms.
Stuff happens.
And bringing along the new generation to join your ranks.
Yeah,
and, that's right.
And that's where the
so important
that umbilical cord is in danger of being severed.
Well, when you know you're out talking to people not in the business, and you're explaining writing, and I say the writing, what you think of as you know fingers on a keyboard, is a quarter of our job. You know, the rest is making up the story, which is a collaborative process of a lot of storytelling in rooms day after day, hour after hour.
Yep.
It's editing, it's casting, it's all of these other things that are not something you know how to do. You have to be taught it, you have to be shown it, and if writers are no longer allowed to be brought up, you know, and shown through the whole, from soup to nuts, the whole process, how are you going to learn?
Well, that's one of the great advantages of coming up on network television and coming up under people like Jim Parriott and Shonda Rhimes is there is a real commitment to this idea that you as the writer of an episode are with it from conception all the way through post. And that training you can do in a 22 episode order, 22 episodes every year, because it's all year long.
Yeah.
And so you do get to see how the car is put together. You're not just at one part of the assembly line. You're through the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes time for you to make your own show, essentially what you're doing is you're giving a writer a $20 million company and saying, manage this as well.
Tony always tells this great story about we were new to editing. We were on Grey's Anatomy, and he walked in, and Shonda was editing an episode, some romantic scene with Meredith and Derek, who are Grey's Anatomy. And, you know, Tony sat down and watched her edit, and he said, during the scene, they were on Patrick Dempsey's face. And Tony said, wait, you have to cut to Meredith now. And she said, no. In the middle of this speech, the viewer is so looking in his eyes, and he's talking to them. And it was just this little tidbit. It was a little moment, but it's learning stuff like that was so cool and helpful.
Every single piece. Well, and obviously that is the big difference between theater and shooting something for television is theater, it sits in front of you. Television, you have to figure out where you want the viewer's eye to go because you're doing it for them.
Right.
And it's all different muscles, isn't it? It's all different things. Now, when did you guys sort of figure out you were a good team? Was it immediate? Did you just sort of see that you could do that together?
Truthfully, yes. But there were some fights along the way.
There have to be.
I think we've had every fight a couple could have. What we finally figured out through a lot of push-pull was that, I'm going to say something sort of controversial, I'm the better writer, and he's the better everything else, okay? And we had to recognize our strengths and our weaknesses and let go of certain things. We couldn't just be equal at everything.
Well, when we first started writing for TV, we tried to sit in a room together and write together, and we found that to be impossible.
Yeah.
And so when I finally was like, I don't like being on set as much as I like being in a corner just writing.
Sure.
And he likes all the other stuff. I was like, duh.
That's the answer.
We split it up. But that took years of struggle to come to that.
Of course.
But it was worth the struggle because you finally found your strengths as individuals and as a couple, as a team.
That's right.
Yeah.
My mom does the business. He's the talent. That's how it works in our household. And they figured that out very early in their marriage.
Pretty early, yeah.
That he's terrible at business. Terrible at business. Fantastic at the other stuff. Terrible at business.
Right.
Mom handles a business. She's a very small Jewish lady from the Bronx. And now she's, as she will tell you, old, so she can do whatever she wants. And it's this, you find your happy place.
Yeah, we found our happy place.
It's amazing what you can do when you figure that out. And then also being able to sort of say, no, you know what? You're really good at this.
Yeah.
You're really good at this, and I'm really good at that. So let's do those things.
That's right.
Well, and when we got to the point where we took over Grey's Anatomy as showrunners, I'm amazed at people who do that job alone.
Oh, it's
because there's
wild.
So much.
Oh, gosh.
Involved.
Yeah.
To have two of us and to have two of us kind of be of the same mind.
The red jacket or the blue jacket?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's the 10,000 questions a day.
10,000 questions. Exactly right. And everyone is looking to you to answer every one of those questions.
That's right.
With confidence.
With confidence.
Right.
Or with the appearance of confidence.
Yes, well, that's
blue.
The thing is,
definitely
it doesn't
blue.
Matter whether it's red or blue, as long as you look like you know for sure
blue.
What it should be.
Blue, absolutely blue. Should we do red? I don't know if we should do. No, blue. Blue's the way.
Just to go back half a turn, what was your first sale? What was the first thing you sold that you wrote?
Probably, I mean, we sold a Lifetime movie early in our career that we didn't know what we were doing, and it got made, and it was, you know, it was okay. but what ended up happening is after Grey's, we were on Grey's for 10 years, we went over to CBS and we sold this law show called Doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very exciting, and it was our baby.
And it was about criminal defense attorneys, and it was, as we were talking about before, it was about criminal defense attorneys and how the system was broken, but how, at the time, there was bipartisan support for things like bail reform. And so we wanted to tell stories about attorneys whose job it was to defend you guilty or innocent.
Mm-hmm.
And that everybody deserves that voice standing next to them, because when the full force of the government is there weighing down on you, who's going to stand next to you and help you survive that? So we got about halfway through production and Trump won the election.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, we've just gone from what we thought the world was going to be to a very different world. And by the time the show premiered, it was clear that it didn't, that there wasn't that kind of support internally at CBS anymore. And I don't think CBS's audience was interested in kind of taking that journey with us. So,
and I will say that sort of goes into this show, Small Light, because, so say, my mom is going to be 80 this year. And she grew up in the Bronx and was surrounded by survivors, a lot of them. When I got my very first tattoo, which was my Hebrew name on my ankle, my mom said, but Jesse, people are going to know you're Jewish. And she wasn't kidding.
Yeah.
That was followed by tattoos are for hookers and sailors. But the initial was, Jesse, people are going to know you're Jewish. I didn't understand. I didn't understand what she meant by that. And then my whole life, again, because of who she grew up with and everything, she's always been afraid that something is going to happen again. And I always said, Mom, come on. You're just being a Jewish, an old Jewish mother who's going, it's the other shoe's going to drop. The other shoe's going to drop. It's going to be bad. It's going to be terrible. And I just kept saying, Mom, I don't understand. Why do you think like that? She goes, it can all happen again. It can all happen again. People always hate the Jews. It can all happen again. And say I've spent most of my life saying, Mama, no, it's not like that anymore. Come on, it's all right. And my dad had a slightly different experience. He's 7 years younger. And grew up in Teaneck, New Jersey. So it wasn't quite like what she had.
Right.
So you were aware of different things, obviously, but just in a different kind of a way.
Not deep down aware. Not,
and
you know.
He didn't grow up with the fear
right.
that she yeah. has and can never put away. Mm. And
one of my classmates had an aunt or a grandmother, perhaps, who had the numbers tattooed on her arm. That was the first time I ever met a survivor
yeah.
from one of the camps. And that makes an impression. That makes a lifelong.
It does yeah. something. But it's, as I say, you know, you go to, we go to temple, we do all that sort of stuff. I had my bat mitzvah, surrounded by different kinds of Jews,
right.
different activity Jews, extreme Jews, less extreme Jews. And it's just sort of, as I say, it's just life. And hearing this stuff over and over again and just not understanding. And obviously we don't talk about politics on our show. That's not for anybody. But something that happened when Trump became president is that a lot of not very nice people felt emboldened to step forward and say, I'm a Nazi. And nobody said, don't say that. And so suddenly, and as the years have gone on, it's absolutely terrifying. They are getting more and more bold. And
the 405.
The 405, where they've got a swastika. So if people standing there and they've got a thing over. The 405 is a major freeway here in Los Angeles. And there were Nazis, proud Nazis with swastikas.
I believe there's a contingent of Nazis standing in front of Disney World right now.
Well, this
Florida.
Is the thing. When Parade opened on Broadway,
right.
they were there. And it's like, I'm sorry, there were what? They're there with swastikas and everything else. So it's not even like they're hiding. They're standing there. And my mother and I have now had conversations where I've gone, I don't understand. How? It's 2023. How are we having this conversation? Oh my God, everything that you are afraid of is real. And I can't quite wrap my mind around it. And especially now that I have a small daughter, it's even more sort of like, what? Because, you know, we're not extremely religious, but I was raised, you know, I love my rabbi. We have a great rabbi. He's a showbiz rabbi. He's a lot of fun, you know, but it's like, it was important to me. She had her Hebrew baby naming. We did stuff like that. And it's important to me that she knows that she grew up like I did and that right. she knows. And there's no pressure to it. I think that's probably the best thing about how I've been raised with religion mm-hmm. is that it's all very positive. And our rabbi is the kind of person who's never talked about hell or death and destruction. He's right. always talked about love and kindness. And so, yeah, why would I want to change that? I love that. I love that what he wants to put into the world is everybody should respect everyone yeah. and take care of each other.
So now I want to know, how did you two get involved with this story?
Yeah.
Well, we watched a documentary, Anne Frank Remembered, that won a Documentary Academy Award in 1996.
Yep.
And Meep was interviewed in it.
Mm.
And
she was actually at the Academy Award ceremony.
Mm. Wow.
And they gave her the director went up to accept the award. She came up with him. He said, this is the woman who found the diary, who saved the diary, who gave it to Otto Frank. And you see there's footage of it, all the whole audience standing ovation for this little 4'11" woman who seems just overwhelmed. And she did say later, you know, they say, did you have fun? And she said, well, Anne would have loved this. You know, mm-hmm. Anne loved showbiz. Anyway, anybody who has read Anne Frank's diary, you know, and we had both read it as young people, it made an impression. Seeing this movie, seeing Meep, understanding more about her relationship with the family made an impression. And then cut to about 6 years ago, with our children, we went to Amsterdam and we went to the Anne Frank Museum. And our son was just graduating from college. Our daughter, 13. And two things happened. We're in the museum, and I'm reading about Meep, and I, you know, she was Otto Frank's secretary, and a young person, newly married, sort of a hot mess, known to just like to dance and have fun, sort of a party girl, when she was working for Otto Frank and when he asked her to save his family's life. And I thought, oh my God. I looked at my son and I thought, she's him.
Yeah.
You know, really yeah. smart, idealistic, but just at the beginning.
Yeah.
Not know, like,
no clue.
He wouldn't know what to do. You know, yeah. on the one hand, he's the smartest guy in the room. And on the other hand, He's not sure what he's doing with his life. You know, I understand that sort of, you know, young person thing. So I had this moment of like, oh, Meep was him. Then we went to the Anne Frank, the Frank's apartment. We took that bike ride.
Yeah.
And that was very moving to be at the place where the Franks had lived. But then across the street is a park.
Yeah.
And there were these girls, these 10-year-old girls doing cartwheels. And I had a 10-year-old girl, you know what I mean? And I thought, oh, Anne Frank was just a 10-year-old girl doing cartwheels. Yeah. And that, to me, it was very instantaneous of like, oh, I want to see that story. I want to see the real people without the mythology, without the sort of historical import.
Yeah.
We just wanted to feel and really make it feel relatable and real, if that makes sense.
So then what we did was we said, okay, there's a certain amount of research we can do, including Meep wrote an autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a great source. But when you watch interviews with her and Jan, and there were
her
many
husband.
Interviews over the years, you get the sense they're speaking of their experience from as older people in their 70s and 80s, mm-hmm. looking back on the war.
Yeah.
So we were like, we are going to need to dig to find out what happened. So we hired a Dutch researcher. She started combing through the archives, and we discovered that at the same time as Meep and Jan were hiding the Franks, they were also hiding about 10 to 12 other people in and around Amsterdam.
Hmm.
And it's not in Anne's diary because Meep and Jan couldn't tell the Franks that they
right.
were doing it
right.
because it would have put the Franks at risk.
Right.
So suddenly we saw, oh my God, Meep and Jan would go daily. They have to go up into the annex. They bring food, they bring medicine, they bring news, they bring books. They also bring a sense of optimism.
Right.
We all know what it was like in pandemic. You're searching for any little tidbit of hope and good news. That's what I'm certain it was like to be in hiding. And Meep talked about that she was their emotional lifeline. And so she couldn't tell them, I'm getting food for these other people. I got this guy living with us. If we get caught housing him, the jig is up. You know, there were a lot of pressures that she was under as a newly married person, as Otto Frank's, you know, so it just sort of felt like, wow, there's this coming of age story happening on the other side of the bookcase.
Yeah. Well, and it is, you make it immediate. That's exactly what it is. And I think that it's true. We all sort of have, there's the picture of Anne Frank everyone can think of. That's the one that we've all seen. And, you know, you hear about the book. And obviously there's been conversations about the father and all the rest of the things. But the reality of it is when you go to see it, and I did go to Amsterdam some years ago, and I went and I looked, and you sort of get a sense of the smallness. In the same way, if you've ever been to a Holocaust museum and they have one of those train cars and you walk into one of those and you go, oh, this is fucking horrific. This would be terrifying. Before anything happens, you're standing in complete darkness in this freezing cold space. Wow, that is not my idea of a good time. And it blows you away. So to see it and make it real. And then you have these young people who are trapped. In Anne's case, you're trapped. You're not happy about it. You're not having a good time. You're trying to keep yourself, you know,
well,
amused.
So they're a family, right?
Yeah.
She's a girl who is 13 to 15 when they're in the annex, living on top of people, sharing a room with
a dentist.
And that's just, so also during pandemic, our son and his husband came to visit. I'm allergic to cats.
Okay.
This story is relevant to Anne Frank, I promise.
You.
We have cats. And my son and his husband were moving to Chicago. They wanted cats. I thought, oh my God, this is a perfect marriage here. I'm allergic to cats. You'll take our cats. Our daughter, who was still at home in high school, was so upset with me that I so freely gave away our cats. Mm-hmm. And it turned into a drama in our quarantine home with all of us on top of each other because I was giving away the cats. And I, you know, and in A Small Light and in real life, Anne wasn't able to bring her cat into hiding. And so we know that, and it's sort of a story that Meep tells, and so she says, so Anne couldn't bring the cat. Well, I was living what that really felt like. That really felt like my daughter was furious at me. I was anxious about it. Everyone was crying. So it was sort of like, let's take these things we know that happened, and let's fill them with the emotion that we can imagine.
Yeah. Right, right.
Well, you know what they say about how we can't imagine a gunshot. So if someone gets shot, we don't have a physical reaction. Right. But if you get a paper cut, we all go, ooh, right. Because we know what that feels like. And it's that kind of a thing where when you make it real, when you make it a paper cut and not an explosion.
It becomes incredibly relatable.
You know?
And how did you proceed? You had this idea now. You were inspired. You were fired up to tell this story or this
story,
the whole story, let's say, a broader perspective than we've had before. Did you know that you, did you think of it as a movie? Did you think of it as a play? Did you think of it?
I think we knew that it was a limited. One of the things that we can talk about now is that when you see depictions of the diary, you're with those people for about an hour and a half or maybe 2 hours. Mm-hmm. We have the luxury of being with them for 8 hours. Mm-hmm. So that by the time you reach the end of the story and we lose several of them, you feel that loss in a different way.
Right.
But the way that we proceeded really was by just burying ourselves in any kind of research we could find. We made several trips to Amsterdam. We got every book, every film, everything that we could consume. And what became clear is that we were going to tell the story of Meep and Jan. But in order to tell that story, we had to tell the wider story of the Dutch resistance, which meant digging into a whole other thing. But that contextualized it. And the other thing that was so important to us was our experience, and I think a lot of people's experience with period pieces, is that there always seems to be a divide between you and the event. There is a, for lack of a better term, it's told in sepia, or there's a distance.
Yeah.
The language is different, and the clothes are different, and their behavior is different. And so we made the conscious choice to not have different language, to make the language contemporary but not anachronistic.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
To pull the audience into the experience so that our goal was to have everybody watching say, as the story went on, what would I do?
Mm-hmm.
And being able to imagine themselves in that circumstance.
Mm-hmm. You say that, and I will tell you exactly what happened. My parents were watching the show last night, catching up.
No spoilers.
And never that, but my mom texted me and said, we just watched 3 episodes of A Small Light. Oy vey, all I keep thinking about is little Daisy. What would we do? How would we protect our family?
Yep.
That is literally my mom's reaction to watching it.
Yeah.
Is she was very upset and said, what would we do for my 1.5-year-old? What would we do?
Right.
And it did. It upset her terribly. And that's exactly it. Is, again, you're making it real and tangible. And something that people can look at and go, oh, so it's not just a book. It's not just this book, this brilliant young woman who did, you know, it's like, no, she was not happy.
And we said to the actors, and this was true for us as writers as well. I mean, this is a true thing that happens to me, and several people have said it happens to them. The way Anne writes her diary, when I read it, I get so caught up in her humanity and all of their humanity, that at a certain point, I think to myself, oh, maybe it'll have a different ending this time.
Right, of course.
I really do. And I think, please, please, please let it have a different ending. And it was important to us, you know, the people who are living through this, they didn't know the end.
Yeah.
Right, of course.
They didn't know the end. They didn't know, you know, there's a scene at one point where they're saying, you know, I don't think Hitler's gonna invade Amsterdam for these reasons. Look, we're neutral. You know, all of these sort of reasons, yeah. Miep is saying, and the German immigrants are saying, okay, Miss Naive.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was always sort of, you know, they were living in a modern world. They had washing machines, refrigerators, toasters, beautiful art and symphonies. I don't think in their modern world they could believe
right.
that barbarianism like this was
yeah.
happening.
Yeah.
And
well,
that felt relatable
well,
as well.
That yes, is well, today, it, is it the, not? I mean, that's the whole thing.
It's the unthinkable
that's right.
becoming reality. You know. And we deal with that now. Well, the pandemic was unthinkable.
That's right.
And we're still not out of it.
Yeah, it's not so, like it's magically yeah. done.
Now, I always wonder about this. You are the creators of the show.
Yes.
You're the executive producers of the show.
Yes.
Did you write all 8 episodes?
No, we wrote 3 episodes of the 8. We brought on some amazing writers. Bill Harper, who we worked with on Grey's Anatomy.
Mm-hmm. He wrote 3 of them.
He wrote 3 episodes. And then we had 2...
Alyssa Jacobson and Ben Essler. We had a writer's room. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't have been able to do this without a writer's
Absolutely
room.
Absolutely not.
I mean, we would have done it.
Of course,
would have been
yeah.
a different show. I don't think it would have been as deep and rich and beautiful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, what it's is a collaboration.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Collaboration.
Absolutely. And you want to take in all the information and have your thoughts about it, but then give the information to other writers, have them take it all in,
right.
because they come at it from a very different place, and they bring their own experience and their own... I mean, Alyssa brought some great detail about her own experience growing up Jewish on Long Island that was woven into the way that we told the story.
Hmm.
And, you know, the other thing is, we're 2 Gentiles
right.
telling the story of a Gentile woman and her Gentile husband who helped these Jewish friends of theirs.
Yeah.
Right.
And so, yes, that's our perspective, but you need those other perspectives
as
well. Of course.
Right, right. Well, I was wondering only in the sense that, and you dealt with this on Grey's Anatomy where you held different positions during the 10-year run you had. Did it feel at any time like you were handing your baby over to someone else to nurse it, you know, for a finite period of time?
No. I mean, even the director, Susanna Fogel, was in on the development of this mm-hmm. early on. We were all of one mind. Mm-hmm. I can understand that feeling, but it never happened because we sort of stayed lean and mean. You know, Tony was in Amsterdam on every location scout, on you know, in on it all.
It's interesting because we shot like 2.5 weeks in Amsterdam. The rest of the time we were in Prague on sound stages and some exteriors. But the Amsterdam portion of our shoot happened in the middle before we had written the last 2 episodes.
Mm. Mm.
So we had scenes that we needed to write for those 2 episodes, but the episodes hadn't been written yet. But I think we had such a clear idea of what those scenes were that we could write them out of context and shoot them and know that when we got to those episodes, we could slot them
It'll
right
all
in.
It makes sense, yeah.
Wow.
Wow.
Talk about casting.
So casting is key, and casting is usually really tough. Casting, you gotta sort of, you know, get ready, because yeah. it's usually going to be a long, drawn-out process of, like, not getting your favorites and mm-hmm. having your heart broken. And we first needed to cast Miep. So here's what we did. Susanna Fogel, who's our director, is, like, a famous texter late at night. So you'll, like, wake up at 3 a.m. and be like, I wonder if Susanna's awake. She is.
She is.
And one night I sort of was like, okay, we got it. We're going to, who do you think? And she, you know, comes, she starts texting, and then she goes, what about Belle Powley?
Mm.
And we both had this moment of, we love Belle Powley.
Yep.
We didn't want somebody who you would expect to be in a period piece. We didn't want that period piece vibe,
right.
you know?
Yeah.
And so we wanted somebody with a sort of a fresh, modern, relatable sensibility. So suddenly she says Belle Powley. Tony and I sort of like latch onto that as a great idea. And then we go back to that. And we mention, hey, what about Belle Powley to our agents? Belle Powley's at UTA. Within a week, we're Zooming with Belle Powley. And a day after that, she says, yes, this doesn't happen. You know, it was just a sort of magical, she was looking for a part like that. She was perfect. We loved her. You know, it was like that. So we said, okay, well, Otto Frank's going to be harder. Similar thing. You know, what about Liev Schreiber? You know, we Zoom with Liev.
I mean, the interesting thing about casting that part is your mind instantly goes to very old actors.
Sure,
but
sure.
You're like, no, he was like in his late 40s.
Yeah. Mm.
So Jewish actors in their late 40s who can bring the kind of gravitas mm-hmm. against this dervish of a Meep Geese.
Right.
And we're like, Liev Schreiber would be really interesting.
We'll never get Liev Schreiber, we say. Because you always.
Yep, yep.
And we Zoomed with him, and he was a little bit, you know, he's a smart guy, and he had a lot of questions, and we answered the questions, and then he had more questions. But it wasn't that, it was sort of like, okay, you know, it was pretty quick. So then, you know, and then I think when you watch the show, just the most magical thing happens with Belle and her husband, played by Joe Cole. Their chemistry is just phenomenal. And so he also, we wanted somebody fresh, somebody you wouldn't expect. And this actor, Joe Cole, that a lot of people know from Peaky Blinders, we had seen him do this beautiful...
He played a romantic lead on Black Mirror. Mm-hmm. And we were like, well, that's...
Yeah.
In that actor, people cast him as gangsters all the time,
yeah.
But he has this other side of him that would be really nice to see.
So the actors were excited by the language in the material, that it felt modern, that it felt relatable. I think, you know, Liev has said he's offered a lot of World War II stuff. He usually says no. Mm-hmm. This felt like the right piece at the right time for him.
Oh, yeah.
And then we got these British actors. I mean, one after the other. It was like kid in a candy store time.
So the only two American actors in the entire ensemble are Liev, who plays Otto, and Ashley Brooke, who plays Margot.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else is primarily from the UK or Holland or the Czech Republic.
Mm-hmm. Well, it works.
Yeah. How... Producing is so interesting, isn't it? Because depending on where you're at career-wise and everything else, producing can either mean that you're the one who's sort of the mom of a project and you're having to try to deal with everything and all these tidbits. And much like being a showrunner, you know,
right.
you're in charge of all these things. It can also be something that someone gets who's just really important and maybe they don't do as much
right.
on a production. For you guys... I mean, it must have changed a lot through the years and depending on the project. But what does executive producer mean for you at this point?
I think really what it comes down to, as we were talking about before, is it's the person who holds the show
yeah.
in their head. And so for the actors, that meant they could come to me with any question they had about the history, about the specificity of the characters, about how to do their own research, about what could be... What would I use in this? What would I have on me? What personal objects would I have? And because it had taken us 6 to 7 years to put the show together, we had all that knowledge, as well as the production designer can come to me and say, okay, so we're doing Amsterdam School. This is what all of our building exteriors should look like. In Prague, we're looking for brick buildings built between this time and this time, right? And I'm like, yeah, there aren't that many, so we got to find them all.
Yeah.
But... Yeah, it's that person who is the last answer.
Mm.
And I think if you come to that job with joy and with excitement about what you're doing, you become also the ringmaster, the cheerleader, who is
mm-hmm.
moving it all along.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, coupled with whatever actor is number one on the call sheet, which in this case was Belle, she has a very similar vibe about her. Just a joy in doing the work. many times my job as showrunner has been about dragging actors out of their trailer and getting them onto the set mm-hmm. to say the lines that they need to say. In this case, the actors were always on set with their chairs in a little circle, swapping stories or whatever, but they would hang out and watch each other work in a way that I'd never really experienced before. It felt very much like a real ensemble.
Yeah.
What a gift.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think that's part of... You two are both very joyful people, and you're very excitable people, which is, it's a lovely quality to have, because it means that when you're on set, that's, as you say, you know, same thing with someone being number one on the call sheet. If what you're doing is going, no, we're here, and this is amazing that we're working on this, and I'm so excited, and tell me what you want to tell me, and I'll tell you what I think. It's the best possible environment for anything at all, but especially because the story you're telling is so important, especially now.
Yeah.
So important now. And so relevant.
You know?
First of all, we're from the Midwest. I didn't know television was written. I just thought it appeared. I thought Brady Bunch, they just came on my TV. So we're super still in the, I can't believe we get to do this part. I don't think we'll ever get over that.
That's what he said about CBS Television City, is that growing up.
Oh, growing up in New Jersey, when the announcer, who I later met, Art Gilmore, the announcer said, "Live from Television City in Hollywood." Whoa.
Yeah.
Boy.
Yeah. It's like a thrill.
So when you see it, you go, that's the one.
Yeah.
That's the thing they said.
Well, I think the amazing thing is that we shot at the Barrandov Studios in Prague. They were founded by the Nazis to make propaganda films in the 30s.
Jesus.
Then when the Soviets took over, they were used by the Soviets. And then when the Iron Curtain fell, the American and British co-productions started coming in. And now a tremendous amount of films and television shows are shot there. But you walk into those stages and there is some history there.
Sure.
Yeah.
You really feel it. Wow. And you also have craftspeople there who learned from their parents because it's a family business to mm-hmm. do this on this film crew.
Mm-hmm.
And so working in that environment, I've never seen a crew lay track as quickly, do their jobs as efficiently. It was a whole different thing.
But also, Jesse, in answer to your comment, or, you know, in response to your comment about how important and timely this is, we did a screening with a woman from the Holocaust Museum of Los Angeles and a guy from the...
ADL.
Yeah, Anti-Defamation League. Yeah. And one thing that I didn't realize, or anyway, they said that it is proven... that Holocaust education lowers anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
Reduces, like, the more you know, the harder it is to hate. Mm-hmm. And Holocaust education is still taught in some states, mandatory in some states in the United States, not everywhere.
Anyway, only 22 states out of 50.
We wanted to tell Meep's story because it's such a beautiful, inspiring story. And a byproduct of it is that we get to help educate people about the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we get to hopefully, reduce anti-Semitism. If you get to know people, we get to have an impact.
Well, and I will also say that Meep famously always said, "I'm not a hero. Don't think of me as a hero. Anybody can do what I did. Yeah. Anybody can do little acts of kindness in the moment to make a difference." And what kept striking me as we were making the show is that I have a tendency towards cynicism. And especially living in the world today, it's very easy mm-hmm. to say, I can't do anything. It's too overpowering. I mean, I look and I see all of the things that I marched for over the past 40 years being ripped up in a matter of
mm-hmm.
2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very easy to say, throw up my hands and say, I'm moving to Europe and I'm done. But to see this woman who constantly walked up those stairs,
yep,
and brought hope and lived in hope and believed in her heart that they were going to come through. And when they didn't come through, many of them at the end found this diary, gave it to Anne's father, and then made a tremendous impact on the world.
Yeah.
It just causes you to say, yeah, every day there are little things that I can do.
You don't know the end of this story. Yeah. And you have to keep investing and believing.
I don't mean this to, after this high-minded discussion we've been having. Was it a tough sell?
Interestingly, we expected it to be a tough sell, and we had two people who were interested in it, ultimately, FX and Nat Geo. And the people at Nat Geo were very clear that they got what we were trying to do tonally. Mm. They loved the take on the story, and they said to us in no uncertain terms, we'll make this.
Mm.
We will make this, but and it will get on the air.
Was it a tough sell? The short answer is no. Nat Geo got it right away and said yes, enthusiastically. But there were 6 years previous to our pitch where we did little mini pitches. You know, as a writer, you sort of take your material out on the road at a dinner party and you go, hey, we have this story about this woman named, you're sitting next to an executive.
Right.
And you'll try it out and you'll see what hits and what doesn't. And then you'll go home and say, oh, they didn't, you know, we're not doing period pieces, and you'll get dejected.
Right.
But over these 6 years, as you're taking your show on the road in little bits, you see when people's eyes light up, and people's eyes would always light up at the same stuff that got us excited. Yeah. So I just have to keep believing, like, this stuff is so cool and exciting to us. If we can communicate it in the right way, it will be exciting and cool to other people.
And the other thing that's exciting too is, and our daughter was doing this as well when she watched the show for the first time, is if you're watching the show and you turn to the person you're watching with and say, that could not have happened.
Mm.
There's no way that could have happened.
She kept saying, did that really happen? Yes, sadly, that really happened. Go Google it.
This is why documentaries will blow you away, right? Because you watch a documentary and you think, I couldn't have come up with this if I
tried. That's right.
Which really is a lot of the Holocaust stories and the different people who rescued and, you know, folks who brought kids over to the United States, like all these stories. And you go, I'm sorry, what? Even the whole thing about once the camps were closed and the immigrants had and they had nowhere to go.
Right.
They weren't let in. What's the one? They put them on a boat to Cuba.
Yeah.
And they to Cuba and they go, sorry, bye.
Well, so it's liberated, right? The camps are liberated. And the people come back to Amsterdam, for instance, in the case of our story. Well,
now what?
People don't want them there.
No.
People are still believing that they're the problem or there's anti-Semitism. So, you know, we hear a story and yay, liberation. Well, then they came back in their homes. People were living in their homes and they weren't wanted, you know. So like drilling down on the, I remember when we went to the Resistance Museum in Amsterdam, this one blew me away. I didn't know this. You know, the Jews had to wear yellow stars.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They had to buy them themselves.
No.
Yeah.
I've never heard that.
They had to pay for them themselves. They had to go to the place. A decree comes down. You got to wear a yellow star. And I remember thinking, well, and then they had to, the indignity of having to pay for it themselves. You know, so it's like details like that that we found that just kept blowing our mind.
I've never heard that before.
Yeah. I mean, the there's something great, too, about the diary ends before everybody's arrested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we're able to tell that story, to take the story beyond
right.
that. and to show what happened afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that really stayed with us in our research is that Otto lived with Meep and Jan for 7 years after the war.
Oh, my.
So, think about that.
I never have thought about that.
He started as her boss. Right. You know, she was a young girl. She was his secretary.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they're from different social classes. They're, you know, and they became family.
Yeah.
And that was another driving force with our story. Like, that's an arc.
Well, yeah. It is absolutely, as you say, a lot of people don't really hear about the after liberation part. Because you're so excited that it happens, you go, okay, well, at least right. They let everybody go. Whoever was still alive, they got out. Okay, great. And then when you hear the stories, they say of they weren't welcome here, and they weren't welcome here, and they weren't welcome here, and they were put on a boat and then turned away. And then they went over here, and then some people went over here. And you start to realize that it wasn't over.
Right.
That it wasn't like, oh, they were liberated, and then they said, here's your house, here's your car, here's your family. You know, it was like...
Although another piece that always blew our mind, and in my sort of taking my show on the road when I would talk to people, this was another little bitlet that I could see the light,
yeah,
them light up. So Otto Frank comes back, and he had been hiding in the annex for 2 years. He went to Auschwitz. He was there for many months. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he comes back. The next day, he puts on a suit, and he goes back to work in the office where he had been hiding above for the last 2 years. You would think, I remember saying to Tony, he didn't take a couple of days.
Yeah,
you
right.
know, it's sort of like, but he went back to work.
Yeah.
And worked, but was also searching for his family. But that little detail too, of like, nope, this is my job, this is my office, I'll assume work again. Well,
some kind of normalcy.
Yeah.
After the chaos of everything that just happened. Yeah. Now, I'd say every time you hear stories, I'm blown away because, and it's a funny thing to bring up TikTok, there are a number of survivors on TikTok, including one woman named Lily Ebert, who I think is 98 or 99, and her grandson is the one who got her onto it, and he just went to Auschwitz and did a whole bunch of videos from that. And I've said to my parents, one of the most incredible things is people can ask her and the others questions, really basic questions. Someone said, what did you do when you got your period? And it never occurred to them. As soon as I hear the question, I go, they didn't have their period. They were not eating, and they were starving to death and freezing to death. That wasn't happening. But for somebody who may not be aware of that, what did you do? And Lily answers. And that's the thing, to get an answer from an actual person who was there and it wasn't an issue because our bodies couldn't do that.
Right.
And, you know, and I'm imagining the person hearing the response and suddenly going, oh, yeah, you probably can't do a whole lot of anything.
That's
because your body can't. There's nothing there.
That's right.
And it's those moments. And this is also why, again, being raised Jewish, they always said we have to know our history because people will be gone. And in the not too distant future, there will be no more survivors.
Right.
That's right.
You know, when I was younger, they'd come to temple all the time. You know, you had a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a long time. And so there are not very many. So that's the ones that are there are so vital. And making them, as I said, putting them on TikTok and making them available.
And they want to pass their story.
Oh, yes.
They are all charged with a mandate.
Right. Yeah,
that's right.
It's their duty. It's their responsibility to tell the story.
That's right.
Make sure people know.
And I think that as we got deeper into making the show, we began to feel that responsibility.
Of course,
as well. Because I grew up with many survivors around me in Cleveland, and you do feel that they are beginning to
vanish. Time.
And as we were making this in Europe, you just meet survivors who are around still there. Yep. There was this guy, Jack, who we met, who was living at a location that we were going to shoot. I think you saw this already where there was the razzia, where they were pulling people out of the apartment building.
Mm-hmm.
So he lived there. He'd lived there. His family had lived there since before the war. And part of the location process is to go and knock on everybody's door and say, we're going to be shooting here.
Of course, yeah.
And in that case, we're going to be shooting here. It's going to be somewhat disturbing. We'll put you up in a hotel if you don't want to be here. And he was like, not only do I want to be here, I have to be here. Mm-hmm. This is important that you're doing this. And so he was there.
Wow.
Surrounded by the cast and the crew, answering questions, showing mementos that he still had. And
when he was four, his parents hid him in the country, and they smuggled him out of the apartment by putting him in the basket of a bakery bicycle, like a baker who would go around and deliver. So this little four-year-old boy is ridden out of town in the basket of a bicycle, and that was Jack. And now he goes around and goes to schools, and it's really important to him to tell his story.
Well, this is, as I say, growing up with it in this sort of secondhand where I have parents who knew it. But, I mean, there's another example, right? My child won't meet any survivors that she remembers. She won't know that. Now, she will, you know, I will show her things and she will learn, but it's not the same thing as meeting somebody and shaking someone's hand, which we have gotten to do, and you guys have gotten to do through the years. Yeah. There's just not, you're but adding another.
But we can show her a small light.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we can encourage you folks listening to watch it, because, as I say, it's not like taking medicine because it's good for you. It is very compelling storytelling.
Yeah.
It's great storytelling.
And Belle Powley is fantastic.
Belle Powley is
she
terrific.
Deserves every accolade that she's getting. And I have so many friends. I have to tell you that I have so many friends, because we're always texting each other about new stuff that we're watching. A whole bunch of shows have just ended. As you know, with Fire Country.
Oh, yeah.
A whole bunch of shows have just ended. And my mom and I don't know what to do with our lives. And so a bunch of my friends and I have been texting going, what are you watching? What have you got? Anything? You got anything for me to watch? You know? And I've had multiple friends say to me, have you seen A Small Light? Oh my God, I can't stop crying. Have you seen A Small Light? It's fantastic. I want more people to see it. Which again is why when Jeffrey said to me, I've got these two, I said, yes, whatever you want. Yes.
Because we've been getting a lot of people saying, I finished A Small Light. I miss Meep and Jan. I miss spending time with them.
Well, that's it. The only reason I haven't binged is, again, you have kids. It's just rude. Because of her, I can't binge anymore. You know, later in life, I will give her crap for this, but it's true. It's, you know, it's harder to watch them and get through them, but it's just fascinating. And as I say, you're not Jewish. That's the thing. This is not something where you go, oh, well, it'll make sense to you if you're Jewish because of this and that.
But,
no,
but
it's
then,
a
as
universal.
You say, neither was Meep.
Yeah,
neither
right.
Meep.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
And she is the centerpiece.
With a name like Meep Geese.
And, you know, we also felt that it was really important to have humor.
Mm-hmm.
Because
that's the whole thing, isn't
that's what,
it?
That's life.
How, yeah,
life.
That's life. Yeah. That's how life. People deal with stress. Yeah. That's how we dealt with pandemic. By making each other laugh, by being confronted with the horrible things. And
Well, I mean, our running joke is we sit down together at dinner at night and we had nothing to say to each other. We've been together all day. Normally you go out. Normally you experience things and you come home and you go, so this is what I did. In our case, I think it's the most silent meals we've ever had, ever. Just sort of looking at each other like.
I have a hard time believing that.
That's how bad it got. Got bad enough that we just stared at each other.
Anyway, we're very happy that we got to meet you and talk to you.
Thank you for making this.
And say thank you for giving us this wonderful show.
Yeah. Thank you. Pleasure
Thanks
to
for
be
having
here.
Us.
Yeah. And where do people...
Where the things and the stuff?
Yes.
You're at Leonard Maltin. I'm at Jesse Maltin on Instagram and Twitter. You're also on Facebook. You can go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews, book roundups, and all kinds of good stuff. You can also watch us. We do live streams on Sundays. We have a YouTube channel. Or you can go to the Maltreon Patreon.
Patreon. That's patreon.com/maltinonmovies. patreon.com/maltinonmovies. I'd rather... pair of columns every month, one about whatever's on my mind, movie related, and one about movie collectibles. So you can...
And boy, has he got collectibles. So come on over. It's fun.
Come take a look at patreon.com/maltinonmovies. And thank you again for listening.